This is Monocle on Design, a show where we discuss everything from architecture and craft to furniture and fashion. I'm Nick Manise. Today's program is a two-part special with highlights from recent panel discussions in London and Hong Kong. Across the next 30 minutes, we'll hear from top architects and designers on the topic of timelessness. All that coming up on Monocle on Design. Hello and welcome to this week's show. Nick Manise here, back in the hot seat, and my thanks to Grace Charlton and Natalie Theodosi for hosting last week's show. We're starting this week's episode by considering how we might be able to design for timelessness. This is a topic that Monocle on Design has been discussing in partnership with Wizook. Together, we've been hosting a series of live panel talks at the Swiss Appliance Specialists showrooms across the world. And the first such panel took place in late March in London, which is where we'll head to first. We'll hear from Simone Brewster, an artist and designer working on large-scale exterior sculptures and smaller jewellery projects too. We're also joined by Matthew Hilton, a furniture designer who has recently turned to sculpture. But first, we start with Alison Brooks, founder and creative director of her namesake architectural practice. She began by sharing how she factors timelessness into her work.
Timelessness is kind of overused as a word. We've even had clients say, when you talk about your work or say to a competing group, don't say timelessness, because it's been overused without people really knowing or thinking about what it means. But it is important. It's totally critical, because work, whether it's architecture, design, art, that endures, that's part of sustainability, but it's also about culture. It's about ideas and about the ideas and the imagination, the creative imagination, how it expresses itself and is sustained over centuries or eons. So I would say, I was going to say three things about timelessness. So the first one is about being close to nature, design that evokes nature, that reminds us of nature, that has that essential quality. I think that's a way of achieving timelessness. The second one is design that positions somehow itself as a bridge between the past and the future, that brings memory and association and experience into play, but then projects it somehow into the future. And the third idea is something we talked about before this started, which was maybe art. Art is the only true product of human culture that can be truly timeless. And we started to have a discussion about that. And so those are my three propositions.
I think that's a nice, and not just because you guys talked about this before, but it is a nice way to bring both Matthew and Simone in. You're both designers, but you're both moving, I guess, into the world of art. Is that a fair assumption? Or you've always kind of been in the world of art, Simone?
I found myself there by accident. And I think what I was doing is I was asking questions. And I think that's what's in the heart of art. And that's part of its timeless quality, is that art asks a question and it answers it. And at least historically, it was in a beautiful way, or in a way that engaged people beyond what they were used to. When you speak about timelessness, it's often this idea that it transcends time. But I actually think what happens is it captures it in such a pure way that people return to it and they don't forget it. If we look at a piece of furniture that we consider like a timeless piece, but not an obviously timeless piece, let's look at something like a Joe Colombo piece of furniture. It's very of the time. His language is literally developed using the technologies that were arising of the time, the colour palettes, and the conversations that were happening in society and etc. But he captures it in an item, and then it becomes a design classic because it's not out of time, it's like perfectly in time, if that makes sense. And then it's timeless because we return to it to capture the essence of that moment.
I struggle with timelessness a bit. I think it's not possible to achieve. And I think I'm on Simone's wavelength a bit more. The classics that we sometimes say are timeless are in fact not. They're strong statements, usually. And I actually disagree with you, Alison, about art, because...
Oh, I love this.
I think the best art is of its time. Artists are soaking up culture around them and kind of regurgitating it after they've done whatever they do with it. And the best of art, the best of anything, actually, comes from quality of execution, quality of thinking, quality of idea, material, maybe. I think that's what makes something appear to be timeless, because it has those recognisable qualities. You can see this has had very careful, thorough thought, consideration. And actually, a lot of things go out of style for a time, and then they come back in again.
Is that okay? Should we be okay with things going out of trend, like bell-bottom jeans, or...
Yeah.
I don't know
sure.
why that was the only thing that came to
sure.
my head.
I mean, the Columbo work you were just talking about, I immediately thought of a bright green plastic chair, which I think is one of his.
Yeah.
And there was a time when I thought that was an ugly thing, and now I don't.
But that makes it timeless.
It kind of makes it timeless, but the reason I appreciated it is because it is of its time,
yeah.
but it's a really good example of something of its time.
We need to define what we mean by the word timeless. I think it's often associated with outside of fashion or yeah. outside of trends. And you could say it's just something that whose value endures.
Yes, that's
and
nice.
It comes and goes in waves, maybe, the appreciation of that thing. But I agree with you as well. I think certain designs capture a moment in time, but their ability to come back and be resurgent and be relevant and speak of different things to different people from different eras, that is a kind of timelessness.
So
it has an inherent value.
Is there... Matthew, you mentioned quality before. If we're okay with something going in and out of fashion, in and out of style, maybe feeling not timeless, for want of a better expression, for a period of time, is quality simply the thing that allows something to have a life that's long enough to come in and out of fashion?
That would encompass a lot of the things that make something timeless. But it's quality of everything.
Quality of make, quality of material. What else?
Yeah.
Quality of thought, that was something that you said, and I think that's really interesting, because if we're talking about something that's timeless, there's an element of it that does capture the moment. To do that, you have to be aware of what's going on, you have to be in tune. And actually what I feel has happened when I look now is a lot of the work that is considered timeless has been made before the time that we're talking about it being timeless. We're in a weird moment with social media. Pieces enter are collected by museums, and when you actually look at the date it was made 10 years before. So it's been recognised now, but it was made earlier. When we become aware of something, that's not necessarily when it came into the world. So we talk about timelessness, this piece is timeless, and part of it I do really believe is this idea of it being of the now in some way, in a very essential way. I think, Matthew, what you were saying is to do with craft and skill, literally the physicality, the properties of it as an object are beautiful. For me, that's essential. But I also think there's a trick in the thing that we do when we talk about these things. It's a bit like how we talk about the concept of genius. You know, like someone's a genius, as if it occurs, a fairy came and like came with a wand and made you a genius. Things happen in a moment and they're not always even recognized in the moment that they occur. This concept of timelessness, I think, is even more wrapped up in that concept of craft and quality than it is in maybe anything, actually, the idea.
Alison, you talked about nature there being sort of, I guess, a foundation for timelessness. With architecture, is that about having strong links with the surrounding environment? Is that about context? Are those the sort of parts that come into this?
Nature comes into architecture in many different ways, and some of it is about context and how a building or a place might relate to that context. If it's in nature, how does it embrace the landscape? And that was one of the main ideas of my project in Gloucestershire. The house would kind of merge with the landscape and become part of the hill and when you're inside the house, you feel like you're outside. Familiar ideas that came with modernism, for example, of connecting to nature in a way, and the architecture's in the background. But then also nature comes into architecture as surfaces, as objects, as furniture. Like even the sink here in the washrooms, it's a slab of stone that's been honed to make the sink. And that makes you think about the mountain or the quarry or the rock, or that the sink is actually 200,000 years old. It's stone that was there before any of us were even a species. Nature comes into architecture in many different ways. Those are sort of timeless sensibilities, or timeless in their qualities, and they enrich our lives. They've emerged from something that's beyond our comprehension, beyond our memory.
Matthew, does that, as a furniture designer, when you're working on a piece with SCP or Case, or I know you recently worked on a rug with Nanny McKenna, are you thinking about nature in the same way? Are you thinking about, does it only factor in terms of materiality, or are you drawing inspiration from it?
I don't think nature is a great inspiration for me.
I'm surprised by that.
Because of the way my work looks?
No, because it's really, I feel like there's a really deep understanding of materiality.
Maybe I'm thinking that nature might influence me in form and so on. It does vaguely, but not really. Quality of materials for me is really important. I was thinking while Alison was talking that functionality is also something that has to be there. A chair that you can't sit in for me is useless. Anything that's designed that you can't use properly is not going to become a classic and not going to be, isn't a timeless object.
I'm not disagreeing with the sentiment, but I don't think that's been proven to be correct. I just think there's so many designs out there that their sole focus isn't about functionality. And this is where it becomes interesting, because we return to this idea of the idea. And they become important because of the idea of why they were made and how it's been expressed in the object. What I really think is interesting about furniture is that so many architects have come to furniture to make work that they couldn't do in architecture, at least at the time of that point in their career. So they've used furniture as a manifesto to talk about things in an object that has the same, let's say, ingredients. It has planes and lines, materiality, texture, all of these things that we find in architecture that they can't explore or express in that scale. And those often become design classics, and they're not always the most functional. I think that's so important. I think that that's so at the essence of
the ideology overrules the function, because then the ideology, the idea has to be strong.
Exactly.
So there has to be some strong element of...
I mean, maybe it's far too intangible to draw up a list of criteria, as much as I want my brain to sort of have. I kind of wanted the designers here to go away with a checklist of three things, and we've certainly got a starting point. Maybe there are things to add to it. I mean, if we're talking about function, if we're talking about ideology, where does comfort come into it? Where does sustainability is not the right word, but where does a circular economy fit into that? Where do all these other sort of factors start to feed into it? Maybe there's not a simple or straightforward checklist. The other thing I wanted to pick up on there is you talked about architects moving to furniture because they can do things with furniture that they can't do in architecture. I mean, Alison, are you bringing art into... you're obviously designing buildings, but then you're thinking about how people use them. Are you going to the lengths of thinking about how they might be furnished, what they might be finished with? Is that also coming into this in terms of the way that you create buildings?
Every architect wishes their architecture is seen as a kind of art. It's an art form at a different scale. And I try to convince my clients that they're patrons of an art. Even if they're commissioning housing or a shed, it can be a fantastic shed. It can be a work of art. And we try to make things in our buildings that are artful, a staircase that's a kind of sculpture. But we have to be very careful that we don't come out and say, this is a sculpture, because it takes a different kind of commitment to just make an object and say, this is an idea. That's what it's doing. And it exists independently of anything else. You know, that's another level. But I do design furniture, built-in furniture, chairs and tables and stools, but not at a commercial level. It takes commitment. You have to commit to art, or you have to commit to design, furniture design. And I committed to architecture. I would love to design a really successful piece of furniture one day, but as you say, it has to be about an idea that I really want to explore, or a material I really want to work with and explore that idea with. But I think, as everyone's been speaking, I've been thinking, well, also about the word sustainability and timelessness. We need to care more about the way we use places and things and objects with nature in mind, and with the climate crisis as we're experiencing it. So I think there just needs to be a kind of ethics-based shift when we think about timelessness. It's not about aesthetics. It's about the ideas, and it's about making the world a more sustainable and equitable place.
Alison Brooks there, and before that, Matthew Hilton and Simone Brewster. We'll be back with more discussion on timelessness in design after the break.
Every week, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Tune in to the Bulletin with UBS every week on Monocle Radio with me, Tom Edwards, or download the latest episode right now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Monocle on Design. Today we're talking timelessness in design, and now we head to Hong Kong for the second of our live panels held in partnership with VZUG. In this next highlight, you'll hear from Peter Lampard, co-founding partner of Design 852. Also known as DEFT, Peter's firm works across interior design, architecture and branding projects with offices in Hong Kong and Manila. Also on the panel is Sarah Mui, the design director and founder of OneByte. The creative studio focuses on public space and social design across Hong Kong. But to begin the conversation, we start with Joyce Wang. The interior designer has studios in Hong Kong and London and specializes in hospitality design in the luxury sector. Joyce began by reflecting on the relationship between interiors and the notion of timelessness.
A great interior for me is like a great film. You want to go back time and time again to watch it. And every time you watch it, you notice something different about it, and you want to have a dialogue with somebody about it. For me, a great interior really strikes conversation. When people strike up dialogues that I may or may not have anticipated, that brings me a lot of joy and reward. And those dialogues then, they carry beyond the space itself, and that in itself is timelessness. I'd say a second aspect is maybe more of a practical front. On the interior side, yes, from a design side, you can somewhat control how timeless something is by the design and aesthetic of it. But a lot of the times, it's beyond our control. For example, how long of a lease does a client have with the space? Are we designing something that will really be able to last? Or is this something that is going to pop up and disappear or move somewhere else? And I think understanding those constraints can then help us design better.
Does that resonate with you, Peter? Are you thinking about how long people are going to be using these spaces for? Because I guess ultimately when you're fitting out an interior, you're thinking this is something that hopefully is going to last 30, 40, 50 years. Does that affect or impact what you ultimately decide to furnish a space with?
Yeah, I trained as an architect. You're trained to think of the built environment that would be lasting decades, if not centuries. And that's the idea, ideally, right? When it comes to interiors, I think it's a little bit different because Joyce said a lease might only last 3-5 years. Maybe they extend, but generally decades is a bit of a stretch in terms of a lot of interior work. I think when we mentioned the word timeless, what I first thought of is the vernacular concept, which is the original timelessness, which is the way people would be building without designers, actually. Just how they're trained when you're thinking about cultures that have a certain way of building that they've been building for generations and generations. And this is, to me, the ultimate timelessness. But we don't really have that a lot in interiors because we're working with modern materials, we're working with clients with commercial agendas, we're working with a lot of different types of variables. Now, timelessness means devoid of trend, if you will. Generally, trends come and go, and the idea of designing something that will last throughout the current trend, into the next trend, into the next trend, I think to me that is now how we interpret timelessness. Most clients will say we want something timeless, but what they actually mean is we want it to be on trend, but then they want that trend to just last longer. And I think that's the hard part, is really having your eye on the future, which is almost impossible to predict what the next trend is. So really, to us, the answer is looking at what is really carrying forward in design. And when you look at things like mid-century modern, right, it's a trend. It was a trend at some period of time, and it's come back into trend, and it's carrying throughout. And so you can look at that, okay, is this timeless? Is this kind of mid-century modern timeless because it's carried all the way from 1945 all the way till now? It's a challenge that everyone addresses differently. We don't really have the answer at this point.
Sarah, you smiled when Peter said our clients want timelessness, but they don't really want it. Did that resonate with you? Is that something you're seeing in exterior spaces as well?
When we talk about timelessness, maybe it could be like design aesthetics. More to me, especially in hospitality, when I walked into your projects, I feel that it's about the touch points, the feelings that you actually use design to connect with the people. Because every time people go to a hotel room or restaurants, they need this type of emotional connection. And in a way, this emotional connection can be represented by different aesthetics. So some could be trendy, some could be less off-trend, but that's where the timelessness comes. So I think that's what we apply in exterior space as well. Everyone needs that type of organic socializing space. So how can we do it? It could be in whatever form or different shapes based on the context or the site. But more importantly is how the function can actually connect to the emotions of the people. So I love that part of observations and how people test it. You design something, but then people actually use it the other way around. And so I quite like that surprise.
You're working with the community a lot. You're doing a lot of public community spaces. With changing needs of the community, does that also impact whether a space is going to have longevity or whether a plaza is still going to be relevant or its current use is still going to be relevant in a couple of years' time? How do you adapt to changing community needs in your work?
When we talk about really public space, the need hasn't really changed a lot. But definitely people like family wants time together. That's timeless. Yeah, but it's the way how they can interact. Definitely when we have new technology, there will be new ways people to interact. There's a new park that we are designing where we're designing a chit-chat or secret chat seat. Okay, let's not look at our phone. Can we design space or just seats where two people can talk privately in a public space? So I think that's something we want to connect or use design to reconnect.
Can you paint a picture of that for us? What does that look like? I guess we've got a lot of design-minded people here. What does that chit-chat, that secret space
so
look
it's,
like?
We actually use a normal bench, but then we add an intervention on it. So it's actually hiding your faces so that when you're sitting behind. So it's like a funny intervention. You found it, oh, that's quite joyful, interesting. But then after you sit at the back and you actually screen off, so people don't know what you're talking behind. And that's a timeless need.
Timelessness is about looking at how we can facilitate better relationships, better interactions. It sounds like you physically given a space to do that, which I think is really nice. But you also mentioned technology there, and I know, Joyce, from talking before, we almost immediately launched into, do I want to walk into a hotel room where I have to work on an iPad to turn on the lights and flush the toilet, that sort of thing, versus a hotel where you can just flick the lights on with a switch. How do you see technology impacting the longevity of a space and our experiences and our relationships within those spaces? How are you talking about that on a hospitality level when you're working on hospitality spaces?
Hospitality, it's also a conscious choice to not be in residential, which is quite a completely different sector. And when it comes to switches, at a home, you can be much more specific about what you want, whether it's that iPad and all the controls that you can have over your drapery, your temperature, your lighting, music, everything. If you wanted to click your hands and something comes on, you can have that. With hospitality, you're designing something that really everybody should be able to use as soon as they get into a room. So we've had a spectrum of clients where some just want on and off, and another one might want an iPad here, another screen there. They might be able to use their own iPad, Bluetooth, and it gets really complicated. So I think the more intuitive, actually, we were, for example, working on a hotel project for a couple of years, thinking we were going to go into a really high-tech programmable device. And at the end, in the mock-up, we actually generated both solutions and went with the more succinct and intuitive solution of switch on and off. It's going to be that fixture next to that switch, so people intuitively know that switch does what.
What does it take to get to that point where you're like, literally all it's going to be is we're going to put the light switch next to the actual light fixture?
Why are we even having those discussions? Shouldn't that just be inherent?
You'd think, but there's also the mood setting factor that you have to work into it. So it is not just as simple as an on-off. The more sophisticated rooms generally, they want to lead somebody into a certain frame of mind. If you're about to go to bed, if you want to feel really awake and energized, it might call for a completely temperature environment. Your bed covers might feel different before you go to sleep. You might want to optimize that. So how do you do all of that with technology with a single switch? You can't. So it's about thinking of all those different moments and trying to anticipate, this person's going to be in this room for a night, maybe two nights. They're not going to want to learn everything from scratch. So making it intuitive enough, allowing them to have those different moments in the room whilst not making it overcomplicated is something that we try to do.
Peter, I was going to ask you for an ingredient list. Is intuition one of those things that you would have on it? Or what else are you adding to a checklist for timelessness?
When we talk about technology, it's about how much of an investment in the technology are you actually talking about. So just for an example, I'm flying to the Philippines quite a bit, and I took one Cathay flight, and I looked to the side, and where the control panel is, there was an iPod. It said iPod, you know, the lowercase I-P-O-D. And there was a place where you would actually plug in your iPod.
How old school.
And it had the pin connector, the one from the very, very first iPod. And I thought to myself, this is a relic, right? And I'm looking back in history at something from 15 years ago. And probably 15 years ago, this was amazing. This was fantastic. I could just plug in my iPod, hear the music. And then the very next flight, they have another feature, which is you can use the Bluetooth from your TV with your own Bluetooth headphones. Which, to me, this is very new right now, because normally you have to use the headphones that they give you, right? So on back-to-back flights, I was looking at two very different solutions on how they deal with kind of the audio environment in the plane. And I realized that you really can't have a timeless way of adapting technology. You have to just invest in the technology. You have to invest in updating and refreshing and... When it comes to technology, it's almost a different world than looking from a pure design standpoint. You have to put that aside in a way, I think, and really invest yourself in the technology if you're going to make that jump.
Do you think about kitting out spaces in a way where we can plug and pull out new technology? Is that also integral to timelessness, for want of a better expression?
We're doing a residential project where, for all of the light switches, there's no conduit work. There's no digging of the walls. And it's all done wirelessly. It's not super new, but it's relatively new, and it's being adapted. And so every time you want to add a new light, you don't need to dig the wall to put a new conduit, plaster over it, paint over it. You can just plug it in, and it comes on the interface. I think that ultimately we'll get to a point where these are more and more commonplace. So I think these type of baseline technologies are very good, and they have to be incorporated from an early stage.
Sarah, do you see these sorts of things coming into exterior spaces as well, or is there really... Once we step outside the building, there's almost a cutoff.
I feel that we are less stressed about technology in a way that, because especially in public space, I would say all the maintenance, all the things that the clients considers takes a huge impact of what we can implement. Because you can imagine how quick a group of children, they could actually break everything in a park. So like whenever we need to apply in technology, so I think we take actually 5 years slower than maybe hospitality or other projects. So we try to implement in a more localized area. Like when we're designing a fountain, so we actually play with how the newest programming and all the different motion sensors, so that it becomes, I always think, it's a joyful, like it's a daily delight. Like you cannot guess which button you actually step on will initiate or activate which bump would jet of the water fountains. So I think there's different ways that we play with it. But I would say for the advancement of technology is actually less required.
That was Sarah Mui, and before that, Joyce Wang and Peter Lampard. And that's all for today's show. For more design stories, listen to our 5-minute midweek bonus show, Monocle on Design Extra, which airs on Thursdays. And if you enjoy print, then do pick up a copy of Monocle magazine as well. It's on all good newsstands now. Today's episode was produced by Maylee Evans, with editing help from Steph Chungu and Lily Austin. I'm Nick Manise, and you can reach me on nm@monocle.com. Thanks for listening.